is a subjective form of interpretation. Because if you come to the Middle Ages, interpretation is to try and establish what the text means, i.e. extracting from the text. Midrash is reading into the text what you want it to mean. There's a subtle difference there, or maybe not so subtle.
Isn't it one contrary to the other?
Not necessarily. You see, I don't want to get lost on this one. Yeah. I'll say it again, Sydney. I don't want to confuse you. The medieval exegetes.
I'm just confused when you finish it.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, let me sort you out, Sydney. Although sorting you out is not easy.
I know, everybody's trying.
See, if you ask an Ibn Ezra, what am I doing when I'm studying the Tanakh? He says, I'm trying to extract the meaning from the text. And to do that, I'll use grammar. I'll use comparative study of words, context, so that at the end of the day, I will try and establish what the original author was trying to say. Midrash, the rabbis knew Hebrew very well. If you revised Rabbi Akiva to translate a pasuk literally, he could do it. Whether his translation, a literal translation, would be identical with our literal translation is another matter. But that to be able to translate a verse literally, he could do it. And if you want to, don't believe me, and have a look at the Targum, not Targum Yonasan, but Targum Onkelos, which is a tolerably literal translation of the Bible. Have a look at the Septuagint, which is 200 years earlier, and that is more than a tolerably literal translation of the Bible. So they knew what the biblical expressions meant. If you'd have asked them what's a kal and a nifal and a hifal and a hifal, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. Would not know. They know the difference between shavarti and shibarti. And yotze and hotze. Yeah. But they wouldn't call one a kal and the other a hifal. They just knew the language like you and I know English. But Midrash is not interested in study of Peshat. Midrash is exploiting. I read into the text what I want it to say. Okay, Sydney? I'm not reading out of the text what I think it means. I'm reading into the text what I want it to say. So that's the difference between subjective and objective interpretation. Now, why did the rabbis do that? That's naughty. No, it wasn't naughty. You will recall very well, because in the last 14 years, we've discussed it so often, that the first five centuries of the Common Era, which are the most formative in terms of rabbinic Judaism, you think about it, that's when halakha is being formulated, our fundamental religious concepts are being defined, our prayers are being compiled, were in fact, for the Jews living in the land of Israel, the most difficult period in our history. Those first five centuries were misery. Destruction of the Second Temple in the first century, dismantling of the religio-cultural structures of the Jewish Commonwealth, the enormous amount of life that accompanied it, collapse of the Bar Kokhba uprising and the persecution of Adrian in the second century, 500,000 souls perish. Beginning of the fourth century, Christianity is triumphant, ushering in the long night of oppression and repression by the church, the impact of which we feel to this day. So they were not happy times. You may argue, when were they ever happy times? And if you look at the history of the Jewish people, in the last 2,000 years, we've had more reason to be unhappy than happy. We know that. In those circumstances, the rabbis did have desperate need to communicate messages of hope and comfort and reassurance to their followers. But their media for communication were equally desperately limited. We live in an age where we have a plethora of means of communicating. In fact, we over-communicate. But their means were unbelievably, because all they had in terms of the written text, the written word, they had only the 24 books, the Hebrew Bible, nothing else. why nothing else? What about the Midrash? Down to the 5th century, there was this interdict, this issur against writing down the oral law, which meant you couldn't write down Mishnah, you couldn't write down Halacha, you couldn't write down prayers, you couldn't write down anything.
But was it written down by some people?
Now, the thing
without
is...
knowing it.
Now, the point is, did people, for private use, note things down? Yes. Certainly. We have instance where a teacher says to his disciple, Puk chazi b'mechilteich, go outside and have a look in your class notes. Yes, certainly. But you couldn't use that publicly. You couldn't turn up in a synagogue with a written form of prayer. You couldn't even use a written targum. So the interdict was strong. So in the absence of the written word, what else have I got?
Has that tradition still been handed down?
No. The Mishnah was not committed to writing by Yehuda HaNasi, but when the Babylonian Talmud was compiled, according to Shira Gaon, that was when the Mishnah was first written down. That's highly plausible. Memory was the tool, and you committed things to memory, you learned it all by heart, and you transmitted it from generation to generation. But, all I am left with essentially is the spoken word.
Is this part of AD?
Yes. No. Oh, CE. Yes, AD for them, CE for us. Yes. See, today it's PC. And, which stands for Post-Christianity and Political Correctness. Which is, in fact, synonymous. The spoken word, the spoken word does have a limitation. Namely, only those people who are listening to me will have the benefit of it. But it was a very powerful weapon, because the rabbi would give his drasha, and more specifically, on a Shabbat afternoon, the people would return to the synagogue to hear the rabbi expound the Torah. Also, mainly you had Kriyat HaTorah, where you would sit in the synagogue, you would hear the text, and the translator would render it for you into your own language, into vernacular, and embellish it with halachic information, halachic information. So they maximize the use of the spoken word.
He said that.
Well, that's why if you look, now one of the things that I don't ask you to do, but if you look, for example, in our sources, you'll have a statement made in the Yerushalmi and a statement made in the Bavli, and you'll discover it's not being said by the same people. In other words, they've received the information, but they haven't transmitted correctly who actually said it. That could occur. When you rely upon old tradition, we know that can readily occur, discrepancy. But of course, that is okay when I'm facing you and I'm telling you what I'm telling you. How do you communicate at a distance? Now, there's a problem, isn't it? The rabbis did find a solution. I'm going to deal with it now. They did find a solution. A very important one. They discovered that the way to a man's mind is through his mouth. In other words, what is ragil b'fi ha'am, what you're saying regularly, helps to formulate what you think and feel. And so the rabbis therefore encapsulated a great many of our basic tenets and principles into our prayers. So we pray what we believe.
I was puzzled over the rabbis looking at Stone's translation of some of the things.
Yeah.
When you then compare it with Hertz's translation.
Yes.
Coming.
Yes.
You've got three different things.
Yes, absolutely.
Three different views.
Yeah, something quite different.
Translation. Yes,
sure. I'll say something more about that another time. It's quite fundamental, the differences there.
Right.
The one, but prayer becomes the means. However, Midrash for us is still the workshop of the rabbis. This is where we see them working out their ideas. This is where we see them determining the message they want to give. Now, clearly, one of the favourite stories that they would exploit has to be the story of the Exodus. Why? Because it's a guarantee.
It's a guarantee.
What's the guarantee? We were down in the absolute depths, and yet God redeemed us. And so, my brethren, if we are down in the absolute depths once again, what can we look forward to? Redemption. So it's not for nothing that in the mind of the rabbis, based already on biblical sources, the first redemption under Moses will be the ground plan for the second redemption under the Messiah. The second redemption under the Messiah will be a reenactment of the first redemption. Which means we'll go up into the wilderness again, we will eat manna again, oh yeah, we'll be organised in camps again. There's a beautiful piyut that we say during Pesach, which lists dozens of parallels between Pesach, Mitzrayim, and Pesach Le'atid. Dozens of parallels, because it was perceived to be action replay.
Forgive me, it's not a distress. I was listening to on BBC News at 5 o'clock, not at 12 o'clock, the news is on the bed. Discovered that there was this conference on anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And this is a conference about Jews.
Yeah.
How they're going to get to stay in a place in the world, whether it's in Israel or elsewhere. Some of what you've said is this.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Is that fact?
We believe that we are working towards a repetition of our history. That's the simple truth.
But what's the end? What's the end of being in the desert, being in the camp, moving forward? Is it again a reconquest?
Well, the point that I think. What is the end of that perception? Well, that's what the prophet Hosea has to say. He is the first, on the first, who actually formulates the notion. You're going, chapter 2, you're going out into the wilderness. I will take you again down Lover's Lane. We will go out into the wilderness to cleanse you. The wilderness is your mikvah. And that's going to prepare you for your return to the promised land. The point.
I see the point, but it all seems to be being put through a sieve, if you like, let's put it that way. But the question then is, how do we end up in the gone through that?
We will end up being the holy nation of God, restored to our boundaries and the teachers of mankind, under the rule of the Messiah. And every Jew will be learned in Torah, and you'll need the Messiah to achieve that. So let's take a look now at some Midrash. And the first question that the rabbis deal with is one that you may have asked yourself, and if you haven't, ask yourself now. Why didn't God give Moses a real performance when he first addressed him? Yeah, he's going to speak to Moses and commission him to take Israel out of Egypt. So why doesn't he put on a show? Thunder and lightning and the rending of the heavens and a great voice coming down. He's going to do that on Sinai, isn't he? He does it for dear old Elijah.
And yeah, he starts with Elijah.
But he still gets the histrionics, gets the thunder and the lightning and the storms. The voice comes afterwards. The orchestra first, the dialogue afterwards. Now, in the case of Moses, all he gets is a little voice out of a bush in the middle of nowhere. And that raises the question, what's the significance? Ever ask yourself that question? Why a bush in the middle of nowhere? Now, if you want an objective answer, I would say that this has to be the ultimate manifestation of divine power. Because if I say God is the author of the universe, and indeed the rabbis say he's called Hamakom. Why is he called Hamakom? That means the place. You know why? Because Hu Makom Shel Olam. the universe is situated within him. Okay? For that awesome, unimaginable power to be able to constrict himself to the dimensions of a bush is the ultimate manifestation of that power. See the point?
Great.
Yeah. The rabbis say in connection with the cherubim, you know, the wings of the cherubim, that God would restrict his presence to between the cherubim. Okay, that's a modern interpretation, if you like. What did they make out of it in the first century? Because I have two scholars who span the end of the first century, beginning of the second. Two of the disciples of Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya. Look at Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus first. Mipnei ma nigle akadosh baruch hu mishmei marom. Why did God manifest himself from the outer reaches of heaven? Yet he talks to Moses out of a bush. To indicate that just as this bush is the lowliest of the flora, it's the lowest form of tree life, kach yaldu Yisrael lemadriga ha-tachtona, so Israel scraped rock bottom. They went down to the lowest level in Egypt. Va'karush baruch hu yaradi mahem u'ka'alam. Nonetheless, even though they were at that lowest level, God went down with them and redeemed them. Shnemaz, it says, Ba'irei, I have come down. I have made a yuridah. La'atzilo miyam, trying to deliver them from Egypt. Message, even if your enemies put you where Dinarod cannot reach you, God can. And he'll get his hands dirty to get you.
It's
message of hope?
It's also psychological to some extent.
No,
they were drawing you as being separate from him.
Well, the psychology of it is important.
Come down to your level.
Well, it is coming down to your level. Coming, on the contrary, not merely coming down to your level, I'm coming down into the dirt to get you. And don't forget, that's precisely how they were. The Romans trod them into the dirt. That's why Rabbi Akiva has to say, in their dire poverty and their dirtiness, he says, don't worry, he says, poverty becomes the Jewish people like a scarlet thread about the neck of a white horse. So the message is very real. Look at the next one. Rabbi Yoshua has got a bit more to say. Rabbi Yoshua Omer, why did God reveal himself from the outer reaches of heaven? He speaks to Moses out of a bush. To indicate that when Israel went down to Egypt, i.e. when our ancestor Jacob began his descent into Egypt, the divine presence was already going down with them. It didn't wait for us to hit rock bottom, like Rabbi Eliezer says. From the moment Jacob went down to Egypt, God went down with him. Shneimar, as it says, remember when Jacob is going to leave for Egypt, he has qualms. He's afraid to go. Why is he afraid to go? Can't speak the language? No. Why is he afraid? Cooking wasn't up to much. Tell you why.
Might be tempted by what's going on.
Might be tempted? No. He knew his Zayda's prophecy. What did God say to Abraham? We'll be quoting it soon. Yodoa Teda, you have got to know, that your descendants will be a stranger, but Eretz and Lohem, which in the language is not theirs. Va'avadum, and they will serve them. But in your time, they will afflict them. And Jacob says, I'm going down. Joseph knew it, and Jacob knows it. Well, that's why he says, don't be afraid. And this is what he says to him now. He says to him now, go, don't be afraid, because Anochi Eirei Imcha, I am going down with you. Yes, you are going down to fulfill a horrendous prognostication, but I'll be holding your hand all the way. Cheshiyatsu, similarly when they left, Nigla Shekhinah Mahen, the divine presence was manifest with them. Shneema, as God says to Jacob, Ve'anochi Alecha Gamalo. Now, this is a perfect example of Hebrew grammar, and let me remind you about the language of the Bible. The language of the Bible, if I want to emphasize an action, I repeat the verb. Eilecha will go. Haloch Eilech, I will definitely go. Tishmu, you will listen. Vayayim Shamoa Tishmu, if you will listen very carefully. Now, Alecha Gamalo means literally, I am definitely, hook or by crook, coming out, getting you up out of there. And no, he says no. The Midrash says no. Alecha means I'm going to take you up. Gamalo means and I'm also coming up with you. See how he does it? He exploits the double usage of the verb. We'll see it again, don't worry. Yalduliyam, when they went down into the sea, Shinaimahem, the divine presence was with them, Shnema, as it says. By Yisamalach Elohim, the angel of God journeyed, he was there, the divine presence was manifest there. Baulamidbar, when they came into the wilderness, Shinaimahem, the divine presence was with them. Shnema, as it says, Uvamidbar, and in the wilderness, Asheraita, which you experience, Ashenasacha Adunalohecha Kashe Yisa Ishepano, where the Lord your God carried you lovingly as a father would carry his little boy. It's a lovely imagery. And what is Rabbi Yehoshua's message? I never left you. You were never without me. And therefore, in your current dire situation, do not regard yourself as being bereft, discarded, and disregarded, because I am still with you. And of course, there were those who exploited this very notion. They looked upon the destruction of the Second Temple, the dire circumstances of the Jews, to say, you see, God has rejected you. The old Israel has been consigned to the dustbin of history. The new Israel, the church, is now in the assembly. And so Rabbi Yehoshua assures them, I never left you. See the point? To us, sitting in the comfort of Edgware 2009, we may not get the full poignancy of it. But if you've been sitting in a synagogue in the land of Israel around the year 100 and thinking about the ruins of Jerusalem and the Roman taxes, this had meaning. Okay? But having made his comment, two later scholars comment on that. Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yehuda Omri. Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yehuda say, these are two Tanaim. Bo urei rachamav shemish amav hayolam. Come and look upon the compassion of the author of the universe. Shekol zeman shi Yisrael netunim batzar. As long as Jewish people are in distress, he too is suffering. Does he suffer? Of course not. But he subjects himself to the experience of suffering. How do I know? How do I know? Shnema, as it says, Bechol tzaratam lo tzar. In all their distress, he has distress. God shares our pain. Then he adds, Ein li ela tzarat tzibur. I now know this for collective suffering of the Jewish people. Tzarat yachid hinei. How do I know that if even if a single Jew is suffering, God shares his suffering? That's a very potent thought. That you've got a Jew somewhere languishing, and God says, I share your suffering. How do I know? Talmud Lomar, that's why it says in Psalms, Yikra'eini, when he, that individual Jew, because it's a singular, will call upon me, Ve'enehu, I will answer him. You know why? Imo anochi b'tzara, because I am with him in his suffering. V'cheinu Omer, and thus it says, Chichol anogea b'chen, God says to the Jewish people, anybody who lays a finger on you, Nogea Bavat Eino, is poking a finger in his eye. And the Midrash immediately points out, Rav Yehuda Omer, Ein Talmud Lomer Vav Elayud, the text should have been written, Nogea Bavat Eini. God is the speaker, and he's saying, they're poking a finger in my eye, but out of deference to God, they changed the subject. Can you think of another example of that?
Sorry, I didn't understand the Vav and the Yud.
Vav and the Yud. The text should have said, Kolonagir Bachem, Nogir Bavat Eini. God speaking, and he's telling the Jewish people that anybody who lays a finger on you is poking a finger in my eye. But this is a kingery. He employs a circumlocution out of deference to God. So instead of saying my eye, he puts it in the third person, his eye. We say this every Sunday morning. Ashelo nasa lashav. Yeah. What's the text? What have you got? Nafsho. But what's the kasid?
Nafshi.
And there's another case. Out of deference to God. This is a circumlocution. It has a nice name. It's a general circumlocution, but you're familiar with it. A deferential circumlocution.
This is not in the Korean tradition.
No. This is it's called Tikkun Sofrim. There are 18 such cases where our rabbis tell us the scribes, the successors of Ezra, intentionally altered the text. Out of deference to God. Okay, we move on. And what does that mean? He says, you'll like this one. Malami, this teaches us. Shekol mi shemazik la'adam mi Yisrael. Anybody who harms a single Jew, you mazik lifnei mi she'amav ha'ya'a olam. It's as if he is harming the author of the universe himself. So this is a message. The Romans are harming us. They've taken a man and beaten him up. They know that this was an assault against God, and they will answer for it. If not in this world, they'll answer for it in the next. And by the same token, because the man Yisrael shruim b'rivacha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu shalui b'rivacha imahem. As long as the Jewish people are in rejoicing and happy, God shares their pleasure. Uva simcha, and their joy. V'chein ha'omer, that's why it says in Psalm, that you, God, delight, lirot b'tovat b'chirecha, to look upon the happiness, the well-being of your chosen one, v'smoach b'simcha goyecha, to share the pleasure of your nation. That is the relationship we have with God, the closeness.
Accepting that relationship,
yeah.
Brings into focus to some extent the comment made by the rabbis over the question of the famous phrase. God said when the chariots that everybody's dancing at the Red Sea,
yes,
yeah. Said they, my angels sing and dance on my.
Yeah, they're my creatures. Mustn't do it. Tells them to shut up. Well, because we say it every morning. We say it every morning. You know, Baruch Merachem al Haaretz, Baruch Merachem al Habriot. That includes the pussycat. Tzar Baal Chaim. But the Midrash, of course, has the foreknowledge. What does it mean in passage 3? Malki yadati et machovav. I know his pain. You think it means God saying, I know the pain they are suffering. No, I know the pain he's going to inflict upon me. Yodea ani sha'atidin lahachivene ba'midbar. I know darn well that they're going to cause me grief out into the wilderness. Shneemaz, it says, Kama yamru b'amidbar. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness. Ve'af al pichein eini moneh milagoalam.
Nonetheless, I will not refrain from redeeming them. Now, we're going to come back to this theme before we're finished today. If I have to jump over to it, I will. But this concept is that even if we don't deserve it, he will redeem us. Despite all our provocations, he will redeem us.
Which leads us to the very impossible question of, if God is in pain and distress with us, why doesn't he do anything about it?
Yeah. The answer to that is...
wait and see.
No, not so much wait and see. From the rabbi's point of view, from Rabbi Akiva's point of view, the pain and suffering is for our benefit. That's right. Simple answer. Rabbi Akiva had no problem with that.
Go and tell that to the people in Auschwitz.
Well, I wouldn't have the audacity to go and tell that to the people in Auschwitz or to those who have survived Auschwitz, because I'm sitting here in comfort and go and tell them. Wouldn't have the chutzpah.
It's a story without ending.
Of course it is.
It's a story of absolutely no hope.
Yeah.
Of a circle that where this will go on and on.
Well, on the contrary, we say that eventually the circle completes itself.
Yeah, but
it will.
I have to.
Well, David, we have to be patient.
That doesn't come down to normal men.
Oh, no, I didn't say it would. You see, the rabbis knew that they were dealing with tremendous mental resistance, but they carried on.
It's a nice story.
Well,
I think more remarkable than just say the way that the Medrash twists the tzara as if it were tzara of the tzara that we will give a Kodesh Baruch.
Yes, that's it.
It's
imagination. It is what is known as the difference, Cyril will appreciate it, between a subjective and objective genitive. That sounds good, doesn't it? Remember the subject and objective genitive? Sounds like something you get in a fertility clinic.
Prolific rabbit.
Yeah. Very good. A subjective genitive is where I, the subject, am in receipt of the act. Right? So I can say, Makovai would be my pain. An objective genitive is where I'm projecting that action to somebody else. Thus, when I talk about Ahavat Hashem, is that my love for God, or is that God's love for me? Ahavat Hashem is my love for God. It's an objective genitive. He's the object of the love. And he says, Machol Vav here, doesn't mean the pains he is experiencing. It's the pain he's going to inflict upon me. His pains, yes, not the pains that I'm going to be on the receiving end of.
Thanks for the grammar lesson. It's an enormous...
Oh, sure, it's a big leap. Well, it'll see worse. We'll see more than that. It's based upon reality of the biblical text itself. Now, how does Moses respond to the invitation? Shachna, b'yatishla. Don't say me, said someone else. And that raises all kinds of questions. After all, he had been in Egypt. He had seen their suffering. He had interceded on the behalf of a single Israelite and killed the Egyptian and put his life at risk. And now God says, look, boy, you've got a chance to bring out all the millions of them. And what's his answer? Send someone else. And that raises the question, well, why did he say that?
That's what he meant.
Well, I know what he meant, but why did he? Why does he?
Who wouldn't? I mean, sorry.
Yeah.
Obviously, but I mean, wouldn't run away from a job
of that big. Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, shall I say it's because he felt inadequate?
Yes, I think
Rob, because he's
a modest man.
He's inadequate. Well, maybe. He's got a price on his head. Go back to Egypt, he's a wanted man.
He can't leave because his speech is impaired.
Ah, so therefore he has physical disability.
Yes.
You know, he walks with a stick and he's got national health gloves.
No, but you can't. He's going before the king.
Yep. True. Right, well, I'm going to take up your point, going before the king. Where was Moses brought up?
In the palace.
As?
An Egyptian priest.
A prince. I'll ask prince. You.
With all the riches, with all the...
But there's something else. He sat in that court. Moses knew only too well how a pharaoh would respond to a challenge to his authority. Pharaohs perceived themselves to be gods. Their people thought of them as gods. So I'll walk into the palace there in the presence of his courtiers and his foreign ambassadors, and I will say, the god of slaves says you've got to let his people go. How will he react? Horrendously. And how did he react? We'll see. Horrendous. Therefore Moses says, don't make me the instrument of their suffering. And you'll see this will be drawn out by the text. This is my interpretation of it, but the interpretation is borne out by the biblical text. Does it make sense?
I'm desperate to see
where it
is in the print.
Well, you have to wait, won't you? But not too long.
I heard another version that when he killed the Egyptian, so early on he was young.
Yeah.
Now we're talking about 80 years later.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's old.
Well, he's old. He's past it. The rabbis of the second century, and I'm very specific about it, criticized Moses very harshly for those words. They're hypocritical of him for having the chutzpah saying, Shlach not yet Yisrael. And have a look with me immediately. God says to Moses, Ani hu shamarti la Avraham ben Abatarim. I am the one who said to Abraham between the priesthood. Remember that famous covenant in chapter 15 of Genesis where he split three sacrificial animals into two halves and a pillar of fire, i.e. God, passes between those two pieces to make an eternal covenant between God and Israel. Remember it? I made a promise. What did I say? Yado ateida shekige yezaracha be'eretz lo lahem. That your children will be strangers in a land which is not theirs. Avodum, they'll serve that people. But inu otam, that people will afflict them. Arba me'el chana, 400 years. And I made the promise. V'gamet agoya sheyavodu dan anochi. I will punish the people that they serve. And thereafter, Yetzu b'rechush gadol, they're going to come out with great wealth. Be'achshav, and now Moses, Hare shavua mevohelet uvat lefanai, that promise confronts me in great agitation, lehotzi et b'nei Yisrael mitzrayim, to get Israel out of Egypt. V'ani mevakesh lehotziam, I want to take them out. V'yata omer li shlach na v'yati shlach, you've got the chutzpah to say to me, send someone else. Rabbi Yoshua said, Amalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, God said to Moses, Ne'eman ani l'shalem zcha Yitzchak ben Avraham, I am to be relied upon to pay the reward of Isaac the son of Abraham, sheyatza mimenu revi'it dam al gabei hamizbeach, who shed a quarter of a log of his blood upon the altar. Rabbi Yoshua presupposes the tradition that Abraham actually slaughtered Isaac. Yeah. Well established tradition. Why a quarter of a load of his blood? That's interesting. All of a sudden, it was 220 millilitres. No. This is an issue of halakha. I've introduced halakha into Midrash. At what point, according to the halakha, is an animal technically dead? All right, you slit its throat. At what point is it dead? When it stops quivering? No. After the first quarter a log of blood rushes out from its throat. That is regarded as the Dhamma Nefesh, the lifeblood. Thereafter, it's technically dead. Therefore, what did Isaac shed? His lifeblood. That vital quarter of a loaf he willingly shed upon the altar. And I said to him at that time, and I said to him, through the enormity of your act, bring redemption, release your descendants who are threatened by death. Now, that promise confronts me in abnormal contention to get Israel out of Egypt. I want to take them out. And you have the chutzpah to say to me, send someone else. Rabbi Yehuda said, God said to Moses, Ani dan be'emet, I judge in absolute truth. Vani malei rachamim, I am filled with mercy. Ani ne'eman l'shalem sakar, I am faithful to repay a reward. V'yisrael m'shubadim b'yad ha'elim u'tmeim, Israel is enslaved by dirty, filthy heathens. I want to get them out of there. I tell them, man, you say to me, send someone in. Rabbi Nechemiah, look at one after another, they're piling it on. Rabbi Nechemiah said, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, God said to Moses, Galui v'yadu alafanai, I am profoundly aware of Tzar Yisrael b'Mitzrayim Tzar Kasha, that Israel's distress in Egypt is ultimate. Haim Shurim Batsara, they are living in distress. Beata Sharui Bereva, and you are living a life of ease there in Midian. Banikwa Bakanti Otambarachamim Lotiyam in Mitzrayim, and I've already taken it upon myself to get them out of Egypt. Beata Ome, and you say to me, Shalachna Beyakishla, send someone else. Rabbi Akiva said, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe and Moshe, God said to Moses at that time when he said, Shalach Nabi Akishla, Bishvuah, with an oath, Bigzeira, by a decree, Uvamiram, by declaration, Nishbati, I swear, Shalot Tikanes Le'eret, you will never enter the land of Israel. Now there's a rewriting of history. According to the Torah, when was Moses told he wouldn't enter the land of Israel? When he struck the rock. Don't knock the rock. And he did. And that's the Torah. And here Rabbi Akiva said, no. He got his death sentence before he even set foot back in Egypt. When he uttered the word Shlach Nabi Yatishlach.
Since we began by
that,
a long explanation. I can understand when the Nevi'im quote the Kodesh Baruch Hu, we assume that this was received from him, and they are passing on the warning, and they're just the vehicle.
Yeah.
Here, with Chazal, said putting words into the mouth of Kodesh Baruch Hu, what basis do they unpuzzle?
Yeah, I'm entitled to be puzzled. I mean, you're entitled to be stymied by this. Well, yes, we know it's homiletic, but how and why are they doing it?
We don't understand God's
name.
Yes,
but this is some message. I mean, everybody knows in the Torah it says when he struck the rock, and suddenly Rabbi Akiva says, no, it wasn't when he struck the rock. It was when he refused initially to undertake his sacred mission to redeem Israel.
But there's another one that says when he was described as
a Nishmitzri. Oh, yeah.
Well,
because
he was. That was before. That was
that
he didn't stand up
immediately
and say, I'm a Jew.
No, but they called him a Nishmitzri. That was their perception of him, not what he told them about himself.
But nevertheless, my son of Arena says that was the time that he was forbidden to go into
Well, I think you can keep your saying of a room and shout it off to whom. If you suppose shall me cry, according to the plain meaning of the text, they saw this guy in Egyptian dress and noch good quality stuff. It was state of the art, it wasn't any schmata. So they go back and say, Ish Mitzri. What is Ish? Mitzri means an Egyptian man. Ish, prince, a man of state. We've got an Egyptian noble on the doorstep.
Isn't it noblesse oblige?
It's just
in Moses' case.
Why?
He's born, educated to a particular level.
So he dresses like
he's
that.
He's a personality.
Yeah.
He's known both sides of the argument.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't undertake what he is competent and capable of undertaking, then in fact that is the fate that awaits him.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, that's a nice logical approach. But now let me put it in the context of history. I made a big kerfuffle at the beginning of the session to talk about how the rabbis perceive the Messianic age to be a reenactment of the Exodus. In fact, the Mashiach is going to be a second Moses. He's going to lead us out to the wilderness. No, so what? Although Christianity was more than happy to consign us to the dustbin of history as the old Israel replaced by the new, they had no qualms about plagiarizing our Bible, our traditions, and particularly then of significance, our messianic ideology. So guess what Moses represents for the Christians? The role model for Jesus. Jesus is the second Moses. He's portrayed as such. Goes out into the wilderness, goes up the mountain, his face is transformed, comes down again. This is a conscious portrayal of their Messiah as the fulfillment of the messianic expectation of the Jewish people.
You can work your way through this.
You'd be amazed how far you can work it through. But you've got the message. And therefore, what did the rabbis do? We will not give you the satisfaction of finding a support for your ideology in this man. Now, how do they portray Moses? As the unwilling, unworthy. Another work which has its origins among the teachers of the second century, if not earlier, and you're going to be reading it within a matter of 6 weeks. And how many times is Moses mentioned there?
Not at all.
Only in a quotation of a verse, otherwise not at all. On the contrary, is he not mentioned? He's written out of the script. Ani v'lo melech, ani v'lo shliach. This is a knock at the Christian.
It's a
bleak,
isn't it?
Well, we know it's a bleak, but for them it was... See, we living 2,000 years on don't see it. It has to be pointed out to you. But if you were living in their turmoil, you know what they were up to.
But it wasn't for them, it was for us. How would they ever know about
that?
This was our...
Yes, but we are downplaying it in our minds. We're saying, no, it wasn't. So if they're telling you that Jesus is the second Moses, what they were telling us, what do you want? The Redeemer was God.
I don't hear that now.
Pardon?
Do we hear that now?
No. Well, it's there very much. Oh yeah, it's still part. It's known as the Exodus topography of the New Testament, which we don't talk about.
But in another context.
But it's essential to their theology.
In another context.
Yeah.
Right. I've heard you say, all heard you say, that you could say the same thing at the occasion.
Well, of course, we said that. The Arcadia was...
I mean...
Hence, what did they do with the Arcadia in order to take it away from Christian initiative? They took it away from its Pesach setting, where it originally was located, and pushed it in where? Rosh Hashanah. So that the message of the redemption of the Arcadia is now peculiarly for whom? For us. So push off. You haven't got a slice of the cake. So we did look. The reaction, the Jewish reaction to the Christian initiative was a very strong one. They had to do it because they were being demolished by it. After all, I go into the synagogue, and I've got people sitting there, and one of them put up his hand and said, you know, the Christian preacher down the end of the road there says, God has rejected us. We are no longer his people. There's a new Israel. Look around us. We're in a terrible state. Nobody seems to care. Our prayers are unanswered. Maybe I'm in the wrong place.
A bit puzzled about the history of it, because Rabbi Akiva surely lived before somebody had made a God out of Moses.
No. The contrary, no. You are talking. By the time you get to the first point,
Paul, we're talking about,
yeah, well, that's 60 BC. Oh, that's 60 of the current era. Yeah, you're talking about 70, 80 on years on. By the time you get to the second century, Christianity is beginning to make headway. It's got a long way to go before it becomes different, but it's capturing the hearts and minds of the slave, of the women. Nero helped them by burning them. Once you start burning people, you encourage others to follow them. They found a good dose of martyrdom to push the boat out, and it did. Well, it did for us, but it did for them.
One of the disturbing things in what we've learned today is that it seems to be, forgive me for saying, what is the point of an individual doing
Oh no, I won't get into that. ask me that before Rosh Hashanah.
I know, you come up with another, you pick a different text.
I'll give you an answer, you won't like.
You pick a different text.
Okay,
what?
Let me rein you in, gentlemen. Despite the efforts of the rabbis of the second generation to portray Moses as being somewhat heartless and unwilling, we know that according to the biblical text and according to the rabbis themselves, he was a passionate defender of the Jewish people. He was a passionate defender. And the rabbis indicate their knowledge of this in passage 6. Look how they portray Moses here. Amar Moshe, Moses says to God, Amar Zeh. Me'asu shinishtabdu b'shibud zeh yotu mikol adorot. What have this lot done to deserve such a terrible bondage more than any other generation? You could ask the same question in the Holocaust. Im bishvil sh'am Avram Avinu. If it's because Abraham had the chutzpah to say to God, when God said to him, I promise you the land in perpetuity, and he had the chutzpah to say, Bamei daki yirashana, how do I know I'm going to inherit it? I haven't got any children, so how do I know? And you said to him at that time, for your lack of faith, I want you to know you're bringing the bondage upon your descendants. We suffered the bondage of Egypt because of Abraham's momentary lack of faith. You shall surely know that your descendants will be slaves in a land which is not theirs, etc. Okay, says Moses to God, Hari Esav Yishmael Banav. The Arabs are also his descendants. Why don't give them a dose of bondage? Yeah, I knew you would say that. Reem came, and in any event, you should have put the bondage on the generation of Isaac. Or Doro Shel Yaakov, or the generation of Jacob. Why have you done it to my contemporaries? V'im Toman, if you'll say to me, my ichbat lach, what's it going to do with you? Then lama zeh shlachtani, why have you sent me? You made it my business, now I'm making it my business. Okay. Great. Isn't that great? Well, 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 you come to an expert with it. What? Remember the story. Cast your mind back. Remember the story. Moses ultimately comes to Pharaoh and he gives him the message. Starts off by putting his foot in it. God said to him, you should ask him nicely, I'm Pharaoh coming up 3 days off from the wilderness. Instead of which he comes in and barges in and says, God says, let my people go. How does Pharaoh react? Pardon? Well, worse than if they said no, they've been halberd, sorry, he does something else.
He takes the straw.
That was a clever move on behalf of a clever mum. Very clever. Why? You are saying in the name of your God, I shall let you go. I'm going to show you who controls you. In this land, who owns you. I can make your life the ultimate misery. Up to now, I was nice. I gave you the straw. Now go and find it yourself. Which meant that he was making their intolerable lives impossible. Because now the entire nation of Israel had to go 7:24 looking for straw. But that was a clever way of showing I'm your boss. But it had a second effect. And very clever. And he does it consciously. He's undermining Moses. Because he says to them, who put such ideas into your head? Who gave you the idea about summer holidays, 3 days break in the wilderness? You had it all right up to now. Along comes a busybody and puts such ideas in your head. So, you want to blame somebody, go blame the busybody. And they do. Because when the Israelite officers leave the presence of Pharaoh with the lovely news, we're now going to have to find our own straw, they meet Moses, what do they say to him? Boy, do they pour vitriol on his head. Oh, they curse him. God should punish you. You put a sword in the hand of our enemies to kill us. How does Moses respond? You know, it happens exactly as Moses knew it would happen. And how does Moses respond? He doesn't say a word to them. Instead of which, he goes back to God and he opens up his mouth. Lama hariota la amazeh. Why have you done evil? I'm not reading the text now. Why have you done evil to this people? Lama zeh shlachtani, why did you send me? We both knew this was going to happen. Why'd you send me? Because from the moment I came to speak in Pharaoh to you in your name to Pharaoh, Heira la Amar zeh, he has done evil to this people. Bahatzel lo insulta et amecha, and you've done sweet nothing to save your people. Remember it? Big mouth? Chutzpah? That really is. The Midrash takes it even further. Look at passage 7. Now, what is Hatzel lo itzalka? It's the Hebrew way of emphasizing. I want to say you've done precisely nothing to save them, so Hatzel lo itzalka. And that's what Rabbi Yishmael says. Mahu Hatzel lo itzalka et amercha? Rabbi Yishmael omer, Hatzel lo itzalka vadai. In the language of these early Midrashim, vadai is a technical term meaning literally. You take this in its usual meaning. What's its usual meaning? Emphasis. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Rabbi Akiva says predictably, Yodea ani sha'ata atid lahatzilam. What does hatzel mean? I know you are going to redeem them. But lo itzalta ela. But until now, Ela my ichbat lach be otam shanatunim tachad abinyan. What do you care about those who are dying and being buried beneath the buildings? Be otasha, at that moment, biksha midat adin difgabu, the divine attribute of justice, wanted to kill Moses. When God saw that he was speaking out of his passion for the Jewish people, the divine act of justice was not allowed to touch him. So we can see that the power of Moses' defense. But God does this to him purposely. This is God's response to his reluctance. You're reluctant. You haven't got the soul for it. But there was a time when you did. There was a time when that volcano in you erupted. When you saw an Egyptian killing an Israelite, you stepped in. He had to make that volcano erupt again. And therefore he allows the people to be subjected to this ultimate misery, so that Moses will come running back and at long last open his mouth, totally in defense of the Jewish people, of the nation of Israel, and take on God. He is so passionate in his defense of Israel, he'll take on even God. He does. And what is God's next statement to Moses, if you look in the Torah?
Next sentence.
What's the next sentence?
Next sentence.
No, it isn't. Next one. Ato tire. Now you will see. What's the force of the ato there? Up to now. You couldn't see it. Now you can. Now I've got you. Now I've lit your fire. Now you're in the position where I'll reveal to you. And that is the plain meaning of the text. Have a look at it. Gentlemen, enough for one session. We'll come back and finish this off next week.